Welcome to the Somerset Emotional Wellbeing Podcast. My name is Dr. Andrew Tresilla from NHS Somerset, and I'm joined by two friends and colleagues today, and I'll say a little bit more about them in a minute. Peter.
Hi, I'm Peter Bagshaw, GP and NHS Somerset Clinical Lead for Mental Health and Dementia.
And David, welcome.
Hello, glad to be back. Thank you for having me on. I'm David Seeley. I'm the Commissioner Manager for Adult Mental Health and Dementia for NHS Somerset.
And you happen to actually be our producer as well.
I do. Thank you. Yes, indeed.
Well, thanks both of you very much for agreeing at short notice to come along today and talk about Dementia Update 2023. So what's new to know about? So there's various areas we could talk about. I think a couple I'd like to learn about are what's going on in services in Somerset. What's the importance of carers and carers' support, and what's new in the science? So which one should we start with, Peter?
Well, shall I take the science one?
Yes, please.
Please do.
So after years of saying we don't have disease-modifying drugs in dementia, two have now arrived. And I think this reflects the fact that we now know a bit more about the underlying causes of dementia. It's complex. There are lots of things that make us more prone to dementia. I don't need to remind people it's not an inevitable part of aging. With lifestyle changes, basically what's good for the heart is good for the brain. We can reduce our individual risk of dementia by about 40%. But we know that there are a couple of particular proteins, tau and amyloid, that build up and become tangled in brain cells that seem to contribute to the onset of dementia. And so knowing this basic science, drug companies have been working for a long time on drugs which get rid of these proteins. Now, there have been quite a few false starts. So a couple of years ago, there was a drug called aducanumab, and that did get rid of amyloid, but unfortunately, it didn't really improve the clinical situation, or at least not enough for it to be licensed in this country as a drug. It was passed by the FDA, but really has borderline benefits. But there's another drug, lecanemab, which works in a similar way. It's a monoclonal antibody, as the name MAB suggests. And again, that clears amyloid. And it's been shown that it's both effective at clearing amyloid, but also seems to slow the progression of dementia. Now, I wouldn't want to overstate its benefits. So it slows the progression. It doesn't reverse dementia. It doesn't stop it in its tracks. It just makes it go slightly more slowly, about 27% more slowly. Unfortunately, at the cost of quite a lot of side effects, including bleeding in the brain and swelling in the brain. But it is the first of, hopefully, a new generation of drugs. And apparently, there are another 117 in the pipeline.
Well, I'm very glad that you've taken us through that science a bit, Peter, because my question was going to be, does microscopic change result in clinical benefit to the person taking it? And I think you've answered that fairly well. But is there anything you'd like to enlarge on in that?
Yes, I mean, it's quite interesting that there have been drugs previously that were really good. They would completely clear amyloid, and yet without improving people's cognition at all. So it's clear that there's a lot more going on than we think, and it's not a simple story just of this protein building up in the brain. So again, although clearly this is going to be big news, and I'm sure there'll be a splash about it and a lot of pressure to have it made available in this country, which it's not yet, I would stress. It's not being cleared by NICE for use in this country at the moment. But even when it does, it's going to have a modest effect, and it will require injections, have a lot of side effects. I would really want to not encourage people to think, oh, it's fine. There's a magic bullet around the corner, so we don't have to worry about all the lifestyle things. That would be a bit like saying, oh, I can go out and eat fish and chips every day and drink 7 pints of vodka a night because I can take a statin and that'll stop me having heart disease. Life doesn't work like that.
So it's about prevention, and what's good for the heart is also good for the brain. And it may be that some of those processes that are healthy are actually clearing waste products from the body, are less free radicals, less problematical issues, because maybe those tau proteins are the end result of degeneration, and you know, the body just sort of storing its waste in a way. Or is that a bit fanciful? Am I off beam there?
Not off beam at all. No, that's absolutely right. There's a huge live debate amongst the research community, and as you probably know, I'm part of a couple of research networks, so we have this live debate as to whether those proteins are causing the problem or whether they're simply the end result of other processes. And I think you're absolutely right. There's evidence that if we have a bad diet, we don't exercise, we don't sleep, then you're much more likely to get these things building up in the brain. And that the best way to stop that happening is by improving your lifestyle.
I just wanted to ask a sort of maybe silly question, but I let me make it clear to our listeners, have no clinical training or background at all. I know about healthcare sort of management and commissioning, but I'm not clinically trained at all. So it's really interesting to hear what you're saying, Peter. And I was just wondering, I mean, the idea of this sort of protein that sort of builds up in the brain is really interesting to me. And I don't really understand the science behind any of that at all, like the proteins and how the body develops them and how there maybe are harmful ones and less harmful ones. I don't know if there's any kind of like potted sort of like beginner's guide to sort of proteins in the body you might be able to give to help me understand it.
Wow, that's quite a tall order, David. And you're not alone. It's not a daft question at all. It's something that people far cleverer than I discuss and debate. But it's not a simple one-to-one thing. So in much the same way that cholesterol is thought to play a part in heart disease, for instance, it's not simply that if you eat less cholesterol, you don't get heart attacks. It's much more complex than that. So it seems as though, as Andrew was suggesting, there's this complex interplay of the body getting things that are toxic to it and then having mechanisms that can clear it. And if we do things that reduce the amount of toxins coming in and allow the body to clear it more successfully, that's when we stop this buildup of harmful proteins. So, for instance, if we sleep a decent night's sleep, we produce a hormone that actually helps the brain repair itself. And that's why sleep is so important. If you eat food that's high in olive oil, that reduces inflammation. And that seems to help the buildup of these proteins not to happen. Whereas if you eat food that's inflammatory, which is most takeaway foods and processed foods, then you get more damage building up. So it's very subtle. It's very not straightforward at all. And I don't think I can give you a simple answer because there isn't one.
And the other two lifestyle things that seem to be measures that seem to be helpful are firstly exercise, because that helps in what is it, autophagy, the body burning off its own its own toxins and its junk stuff. So exercise, muscle moving, and exercise does not have to mean lycra. Any activity is good. Standing up from a chair and sitting down again is better than nothing. But any level of activity is beneficial. And the other thing that seems to be current, and I'd be interested in your thoughts on this as a scientist, Peter, is something called time-restricted eating, on the basis that if we eat steadily through the day, and so there's food being processed for 16 or 18 hours a day, then the gut is working, it's putting stuff through the liver, it's sending sort of end products, some of which are beneficial, some of which may not be, round the system. Whereas if we restrict our eating, not fasting, but restrict our eating to a certain window, apparently I'm told that the theory goes that whether it's the circulatory system is cleaner for longer, but there's less stress in a very broad sense on the body's systems of self-cleansing.
I think that's absolutely right, Andrew. And so this idea of intermittent fasting, which has become popular recently, exactly allows that autophagy, that clearing of toxins to happen. We know now that having snacks throughout the day is a bad idea, and we don't need it. We only need it if we have very food that's very high in sugar, so that the body then produces lots of insulin that pulls the sugar down, and then we feel hungry, and then we need a snack to stop ourselves feeling hungry. If you have a low sugar diet, which we should all be having, you don't need to top up with snacks. And it's a much healthier way to be. And we're understanding more and more that dementia, some people call it type 3 diabetes, it's a metabolic disease, often because of high insulin levels in the body, because we're eating the wrong high sugar, high refined food throughout our lives. So a Mediterranean diet is the one that comes out top, as you probably know, in terms of a healthy lifestyle.
Thank you. That's a really fascinating canter around some of the mechanisms that are involved in dementia and what we can do to help ourselves. But let's think about the carers, those people who are living with somebody with dementia, who are looking after them. Think about that as a topic. From the two of you, what would you like to say? What's happening at the moment and what needs to happen? David, perhaps.
Just a quick comment just to add to the previous discussion we had. Reading a BBC article, which was about this breakthrough in November last year. And I just wanted to ask your opinion on the phrase they use here, which is, I think obviously they're trying to simplify this so people understand it. But they said, lecanemab attacks the sticky gunge called beta amyloid that builds up in the brains of people with Alzheimer's. I just was struck by that phrase, sticky gunge. Do you think that is an appropriate analogue for what it does, or is that just a strange term to use?
I think it describes it very well. But as I say, we're not sure whether the gunge is causing the problem or if it's just gunge that's there as a byproduct of doing bad things.
Excellent. Okay, so the sticky gunge was correct. That's right. I just wanted to double check. Yeah. I had some people that knew what they were talking about. That's brilliant. So, Andrew, you were asking about carers and the importance of carers and how...
Absolutely.
What we need to do to help them and support them in the system.
Because we recognise that looking after somebody with a chronic illness of any sort is a challenge, and dementia can be particularly challenging. You may have been life partners for many years, and you certainly probably don't sign up for a new job role and a job description of hard work and caring in your 70s or 80s as can often happen, or younger.
No, it's a very, very good point. And we know as well that the effects of the pandemic on people who are carers have been tremendous, really, in that a lot of the things they were relying on for sort of respite or extra support during the day, during particularly the phases of lockdown, had to stop. And so those people who were carers, unpaid carers, often are reaching burnout at a faster rate than they were prior to that, because those sort of mechanisms of support and coping that they had were removed for one reason or another. A lot of those have restarted now. Peter?
So at our conference, dementia conference yesterday, we heard very movingly from a carer who said, what other situation would you expect a human being to be on call doing something strenuous, stressful and difficult for 24 hours a day for no pay? And yet that's what hundreds of thousands of carers across the country do. And I know, David, with the new dementia pathway that we're putting in place that you're leading on in Somerset, we're doing our best to help carers. So do you want to describe a little bit about what that help can involve?
And just before you do, who else signs up for that or doesn't sign up for it? Actually, mothers, particularly mothers. I was going to say mothers and fathers or new parents, but often it's the mother that carries the burden.
I tried to split it 50-50 with my wife.
well done.
Just to clarify. It's a hugely important thing that we need to do a lot more to support people who are carers and find themselves in that situation. And I think, was it on the Care As You Are episode, which we did, which was about that film that the local producers have made around that experience of somebody kind of finds themselves in that position as a carer. And obviously, nobody expects that in life, and sometimes it's foisted upon you, and it can be. There's so much complexity to that, from everything from what do I actually have to do, like every day, like how do I do the personal care the person needs, through to like what forms do I fill in to get the benefits I need, and then also the changes that means in your relationship with the person as well, because it might be your wife or a family member, and it's going to entirely change the relationship by adding a transactional element to it. It's a situation that people do find themselves in. And when they do, we need to make sure that we put as much support in place for them as we possibly can. So one thing we've been doing lately is that we put a business case together and put that to the system at the end of last year to create something. We created something called the Somerset Dementia Wellbeing Model. And the idea is that model is now becoming the Somerset Dementia Wellbeing Service. And we were lucky enough to get some funding from the system, which is really good, and to be able to start realizing some elements of our vision for the service. But the whole point is to add an enhanced level of community support for people in Somerset. Once somebody is diagnosed with dementia, we need to make sure that that person and their carer is looked after as much as possible and given all the tools that they need to succeed moving forward, or to manage that as well as they can. So we've done a lot of work co-production with people with dementia and their carers in the process of developing this, and it's been done across the system as an integrated care system piece of work. So we've had great support and buy-in from our colleagues in the council, from the voluntary community and social enterprise sector, which is VCSE for anyone. So if I refer to VCSE from now on by accident, that's what you know it stands for. And so there's so many fantastic organisations in Somerset that operate in that space. Everybody from the Alzheimer's Society and Dementia UK to like Reminiscence Learning, and then smaller micro providers as well. We wanted to very much follow a couple of existing models that are already out there, but make them very Somerset specific. So we looked at the Bristol Dementia Wellbeing Service, the Sandwell model, which is one that NHS England really believe in, and we looked at our own Open Mental Health Service, which was a transformational thing we put in place off the back of a bid for some funding for that. And the whole point of Open Mental Health is empowering an alliance of VCSE organisations to work together in equal partnership with Somerset NHS Foundation Trust to deliver those community mental health services in Somerset. We want to do the same thing with dementia. We took all of those different things, put them together in a sort of big mixing pot, talked about it as a multi-organisational group, and then talked to people with dementia and their carers to find out what they wanted and what they needed, which I'll go into in a second because I can tell you what came out of those discussions. But I think Peter might have something to add at this point.
I was just, some people listening might be surprised that you used two words together, David, Somerset Emotional Dementia Wellbeing Service, because dementia is the most feared diagnosis in the over 50s. And so the idea of people living well with it is one that we foster, but it can be a challenge, as we know. And anyone who is questioning that, I would invite them to listen to the podcast that we did a while back with Jennifer Butte, who shows how it's absolutely possible to live as well as possibly with dementia.
Yeah, that's such a good episode. It's called Glorious Opportunity for anybody that's looking it up on our back episodes, but it's there for you along with the other deep dives. So I'll just give you a little bit of an overview of some of the key areas that we found from those conversations with people with dementia and their carers, and a little bit more about the overarching aims of the service. I won't go into it in too much detail, but just a little bit of the elevator pitch and a little bit further. Essentially, the Somerset Dementia Wellbeing Service's vision, the elevator pitch for it, is the Somerset Dementia Wellbeing Service is a collaboration between VCSE and statutory dementia services who are working together to improve diagnosis, enhance support in the community, and provide an excellent, consistent service for people with dementia and their carers in Somerset. We talk to people through our sounding board focus group. We've come up with a visual model for the Somerset Dementia Wellbeing Service, which is not going to go across well in podcast form. But imagine a forget-me-not flower, okay? And in the middle, and there's five petals, and in the middle it says Somerset Dementia Wellbeing, and on each of the petals is one of our overarching values. This is what we're trying
to do. Pale blue petals for anybody listening. Forget-me-nots, and a little yellow sort of smile in the centre.
And
so pale blue petals.
We could do a bit of a mindfulness visualization here, can't we? Close your eyes and imagine the blue flower with a yellow center. So these are the five values that are on there. So these are what came out of those conversations with the system and with people with dementia and their carers. The first thing people wanted was access to trusted local dementia information on demand. Second thing was more staff and training for local dementia services. Third thing was co-producing services and listening to people. Fourth was working together to improve equality across Somerset. And the fifth one is providing more support for all carers. And just to clarify, the one about equality means equality in every sense, but certainly equality of provision and making it more consistent across the county, because it can vary at times depending on where you live, which we need to address. So those were the five kind of values, top values that came out of it. And we boiled that down to five key goals as well. So I'll quickly just run through those. So the first one is we need to co-produce improved diagnosis processes and performance and boost post-diagnostic support for all people in Somerset, wherever they live or engage with services. Post-diagnostic support is basically a sort of formal way of saying once a person is diagnosed with dementia, what happens next for them? How can we support those people? The second goal was to provide quick access to trusted localized dementia information physically, digitally, and by phone call. And we'll get into that in a bit more detail in a minute, maybe. Third is to provide better dementia training for all carers, paid and unpaid, and all health and care staff involved in dementia care. Fourth is to raise awareness of dementia across the community and make Somerset a dementia-friendly community, the entire county, which is a very lofty goal, but we should work towards it. And the last one was to provide more support, respite, and opportunities for networking and peer support for all carers. So that's just a quick rundown of the values and goals. And we've got some specific stuff we are doing to deliver those things, which I might get into in a minute. But Peter.
And I think it's important to stress that even with these 117 other drugs coming along, unfortunately, once the sticky gunge, as you called it, has lodged in our brain, even if we get rid of it, brains don't recover generally. Nerve cells, sadly, have much less ability to recover than other cells in the body. So even if there are advances in treatment, people are still going to need help with dementia for a very long time to come.
Certainly.
And that's why it's so important.
Definitely. And that's why we want to address and put more support for people in the community to help people live with dementia as well as possible and for as long as possible, as close to home as they can for that period of time in their lives and avoid unnecessary admissions to hospitals, etc. as well, because it's not great for the person and it's not great for anybody involved. So we need to make sure people stay as well as they can, as close to home for as long as possible. And so all the things we put in place are to hopefully help people to do that and to help their carers as well through that journey.
Now, Andrew, you introduced this as being an update on the latest things, stop pressing dementia. And I think there's one other thing that it might be worth just running through that people might have come across. So for a long time, we've known about the risk factors for dementia. We know that it's around, as you say, lack of exercise, poor diets, diabetes, high blood pressure, smoking, excessive drinking, all of those things. But there was in The Lancet that came out a year or two ago, there was a surprise that it looked as though hearing loss was also associated with dementia. And initially the thought was maybe it's just another marker of neurodegeneration. Maybe it, like we say, it's an association, but not a cause. But there are now trials going on to look at this, and it looks as though actually, if you can improve people's hearing with a hearing aid, it may reduce their risk of getting dementia. So that's a pretty new finding. It's still being debated. Some of the trials are still ongoing. But I think I would say to anyone, if you have hearing loss, then it's well worthwhile getting a hearing aid, and that may well reduce your chances of dementia. And we know, for instance, that social isolation and depression are linked with dementia. So it may be that that's how that happens. So just a sort of a fairly minor thing that I thought people might be interested to learn about.
I'm very pleased you've mentioned that, because I think hearing loss can cut us off from the world and certainly would contribute to not being engaged. And we know that the brain, like many other organs, use it or lose it. The more we use it, the more it's kept active. And I'm glad you mentioned depression, because I remember as a junior doctor many years ago doing psychiatry, and to tease out the difference between dementia and depression is quite difficult, because sometimes somebody looks as though that they've become forgetful, they've disengaged, but actually it might be depression. Can you just share anything on that briefly, Peter?
Yes. And again, it's a very subtle distinction. So I'm glad you brought it up. I was involved in writing the NHS booklet on older people's mental health for GPs. And it's something we covered there. So it can be extremely difficult to tell between. And we're now recognizing another fairly new thing, that in the early stages of dementia, even before the memory loss appears, a lot of people will get anxiety or depression as an early sign before the memory loss. So that makes it even more difficult to be sure about. And when we get depressed, we're not able to attend to things. So a lot of people will become forgetful because of depression or anxiety. And at the end, in the end of the day, often you can't, as a clinician, be sure which it is. There are no magic tests that tell you. And sometimes the only way is actually to treat the depression and see if the memory loss improves.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I remember as the junior doctor, we were doing psychiatry. I was doing psychiatry, and part of my job was to do the ECT list, which was very much, well, it was still being used in the early 1980s, mid 1980s, but not very much compared to long before that. But I always remember a gentleman brought in his elderly wife and said, "Please give her ECT." And we thought, "Well, she's got dementia." But he said she's had it four times before and it's worked every time. And it was quite dramatic, the change in this lady. But I have to say, I don't think that would be standard treatment or approach these days. We would very much more. We've got much better antidepressant medication. Peter.
ECT is still in the NICE guidelines for resistant depression. And to unpack it for people who aren't familiar with the acronym, it's electroconvulsive therapy, which is, it sounds sort of barbaric and 19th century, but no, absolutely. My aunt used to have it every 10 years or so, and it would put her right for 10 years. And each time we try the new antidepressant that had come out, and each time that failed, and ECT was the only answer. So although it sounds bizarre and we don't know how it works, it seems to be useful as a last resort in some people with severe resistant depression.
That's brilliant. Thank you, Peter. I was going to ask you about ECT, to break that down a little bit. Yeah, you're right. It does sort of sound sort of Victorian or something, doesn't it, almost, when you say, but, you know, if it's effective, it's effective, I suppose, at the end of the day.
There are lots of treatments both in psychiatry and elsewhere where we have no idea how they work or why they work, but
just
they
do. That's brilliant. But just to elaborate slightly on some of the things I was talking about a minute ago that we put in place, there's a couple of things we can already talk about because we're implementing the service as we go. And there are elements that are going to come online soon that I can't really talk about in detail because we'll give you more information when it comes. But we are going to be putting in place a program of care education courses, which will be free for people to access. And they will give you everything from that personal care to what forms to fill in for the benefits that you're eligible for, all the way through to, you know, how to cope yourself, what to do, and to be able to give you that opportunity to network with other carers. And there will be a website that's coming, etc., as well. I won't say any more about that yet because I'm not sure what the website address will be for sure. But there's a couple of things we do have concretely that I can announce. And one is that we have already launched our new localized version of the Dementia Connect phone line in Somerset. Which is a phone line that anybody can phone, whether you're a person with dementia, a carer, a clinician, or somebody who's interested in dementia. The phone number for that is 01458 251 541. And that gets you in touch with one of our dementia support workers who are provided by the Alzheimer's Society. And they can answer your question if it's something that's within their sort of remit or their knowledge. And if it's a clinical question, they can ask our memory assessment service team to provide you with an answer. So they're able to provide that localized information because the other version of Dementia Connect is a national phone line. So we've commissioned an extra bit in Somerset for people. There's also an email address if you want to get in touch that way instead, which is somerset@alzheimers.org.uk. So that's there now for people to use. Peter.
And I would just want to urge anyone listening from outside Somerset that they will find, obviously not as good as the one that you're organising, David, but there will be support available in other areas. So I would encourage anyone who's concerned about somebody who is living with dementia, and indeed anyone who's concerned about either their own memory or the memory of somebody that they're who's a loved one, to get in touch with the local GP. And I'd stress, we all know general practice and the NHS generally is under huge pressure, but we're very keen to see people as early as possible with memory problems. So if you think you have a memory problem, whatever part of the country you're from, please contact your GP as soon as possible.
And also to add that the dementia support workers we're talking about, there should be an equivalent in most areas of the country. They might be called dementia navigators or something similar. But their whole point of them is that when you have been given a diagnosis of dementia, you should be connected with a person who knows what is happening in the local area and is trained. And they will then put you in touch with whatever services and support you need. And they'll help you to navigate the system to take those next steps. So you don't, nobody should feel alone once they have that diagnosis of dementia. And that's something that we want to address in Somerset particularly. And the other thing to say, if you have a look in the show notes description when this comes out and you live in Somerset, you will find a list of the road shows that we are going to be having across the county. So these will be starting at the end of February and running through till the end of May. And there'll be one in each of the 13 PCN areas in Somerset, which is Somerset's divided. I won't go into that now. Somerset's divided up into 13 areas, but there'll be one near you somewhere, and you'll be able to come down and talk to the services that are there in your local area, who all have a sort of a trade stand there. There may be some sort of interactive elements that are available. I think hopefully we've got the council to bring their interactive projectors down so that people can have a look at those and things. There should be a big bus parked outside, which is a virtual dementia simulator, and there'll be opportunities for clinical staff to have a training session in the morning and in the afternoon, and it'll be open to the public to have a 10-minute experience throughout the day in the middle of the day. So I won't announce any of the actual dates and stuff now because that'd be really boring to listen to, but if you have a look in the description, you should find the date and time of one that is near you, and please come on down and find out about everything that we're doing in Somerset. It'd be lovely to see you,
and we'll put the other links in the show notes as well. So thank you both, Peter and David, very much for a really comprehensive dementia update 2023 as to what's happening in Somerset and elsewhere. And Peter, I love the bits about what's good for the heart is good for the brain. Prevention is better than cure. So I'll just finish up, if I may, with the five ways to well-being, to mental health well-being, are connect with others, be active physically, move our bodies, learn something, learn a new skill, give, and be present, be mindful, be in the now. Live life now. Go well. And thank you, everybody, for listening.
You've been listening to the Somerset Emotional Wellbeing Podcast, hosted by Dr. Andrew Tresidder and Dr. Peter Bagshaw. The show was created by David Seeley and was produced by Rob Huns Music on behalf of the Somerset Clinical Commissioning Group.